try to solve the most difficult question of this course, what religion is. We cannot compare things of which we are not sure what we mean by them. I gave you an example of the governments, the various states. They have different constitutions, but they are all states over the whole globe, and you assume today that except for some dark spots in Africa, there is a nation everywhere over the globe. And so when you compare governments, you have to know that there has to be government in each spot of the world. Otherwise, you cannot compare the different forms of government. That entails a big order, because it means that two things. We first must know what it is, and second, we, in our heart of hearts, we must admit that it is necessary. This is mostly overlooked in your nice definitions on your bull sessions. You discuss God and politics, but you are never quite sure, since you are at this moment, after all, before your responsibility, that it has to be. For example, it's very nice to discuss girls, but the question is, are you already mature enough to know that one day you have to be married? It's very different, you see, to pass muster the beauties and amenities of sex life by itself, or to know that in the end you will have to line up with the people who find the solution of their sex troubles in marriage and then go on to other things and do not adore the passions of your sex, or of your power to procreate, of your potency by itself. And as long as a boy or an adolescent, or be it even a grown-up man, is only interested in sex, he really cannot be talked to, because he plays with it. And that's beneath the dignity of any human being. Sex is not to be played with, although you do play with it. That is, sex is play with love. Playing with love is obviously not the way of really coming to know what it has given us for. And therefore, I cannot talk to you easily about marriage before I haven't gotten you to the concession that to play with sex is an inferior affair, very inferior. We do many inferior things, gentlemen, and we play with politics. I mean, you know how in this country the people at Harvard or at Dartmouth in the 30s were all communists. Well, they weren't communists, although Mr. Remington went to jail for perjury, saying he hadn't been a communist. He was very stupid, because he should have admitted that he played with communism, you see. He did. So you to play with politics is very nice. But to be in politics comes in quite different. And to be responsible for a government means to be a statesman. Then you are even more than a politician. So you have three degrees, you see, playing with politics, making a business out of politics, and being really, you see, serious about politics. Can you see the difference? Now, gentlemen, pardon me, it is more difficult even to know what religion is, because it is the most difficult and the most independent activity of men. And in reporting on this problem, to find out that religion is everywhere, that it is with everybody, and that it is necessary and serious, is so difficult to explain to you, because the higher up we come in all ways of life, gentlemen, the more ready is the corruption. And I will give you, to show you that we really are dealing with the frailest and the most difficult task there can be, the old Latin adage, corruptio optimi pessima. Carry this with you if anybody asks you about religion, and you will have 9/10 of your answers to most people who talk to you about the subject. Corruptio optimi pessima. The corruption of the best is always the worst. Gentlemen, a good woman is far superior to a good man. But when she is corrupted, she's much worse than any man. Because a good and perfect woman is a great gift of God. You can corrupt her, you see. If she becomes a maniac or a whore or a hysteric mother, you see, matriarch, she becomes a viper. Generations of vipers, and you have heard of this book probably. And Therefore, gentlemen, when people tell you that most religion is corrupt, you just have to agree with this and say, of course, it is so corrupt because it is so easily corrupted. The corruption of the best always is the worst. Hesima means worst. Optimi is of the best, and corruptio, I don't have to translate, that's just corruption. The corruption of the best is always the worst. A car, gentlemen, you think, of course, is your most precious idol. The only thing you worship are cars. That's your religion. But you will admit that a car can easily be found out to be corrupt. It doesn't run. And you declassify it and junk it and say it no longer is a car. But a religion that doesn't work, you have a hard time to find out, you see, before you say it's a superstition. And therefore, the terrible thing about this is the corruption is also the hardest to detect. The corruption of a religion is harder to detect than the corruption of a car. Because although religion also makes you run, like a car, you see. You can immediately see if the car runs, but you can't see it as well with religion. You usually only see it on the deathbed of the man, whether he had the right kind of religion. Or even in his afterlife, in his reputation afterwards. So religion is the hardest to detect as to its quality of being the best or the worst, of being good or evil, of being right or wrong, of being alive, you see, or being impotent. Well, this is only as a kind of preface, gentlemen, to my task. I told you I wanted to make sure that you wouldn't mistake religion for all the many other things for which it is mistaken today. One was philosophy. Religion is the opposite from philosophy because it conquers the mind to the actions of the rest of our bodies, whereas philosophy tries to make all the other limbs of the body bow to the inside of the mind. Philosophy starts here, doesn't it? But we said religion is a power that makes us act or makes us not act, that makes us desist from action, or makes us forced to action we had never considered before. It's the opposite from philosophy. And we said also it is the opposite from theology. Theology is the justification of a religion to the mind, to the philosophers. It's a conversation between religion and philosophy. It isn't religion. Now, in this country, however, at this moment, people have at best a little bit of a philosophy. And as I told you from this Englishman who said 40 years ago something about America, he said there is no religion in America. Which is a big order, but we will have to hear the worst about us in order to escape the corruption of religion. What then is it? It is not philosophy, it is not theology. We said it is our two commands in one. It is the power to obey God more than men, and it is the power to place life above death, living beings above dead things. Now again, in this country, with the domination of the brain, of your reason, or whatever you call it, there's very little religion, because I can prove this to you. My two commands, God, obey God more than men, and treat living beings different from dead ones. If you find it today in American slang at all, it would run, be free, would be the first command. Have liberty. And there it would be very unclear to whom you obey in your liberty, you see, yourself or God. And most people would think themselves. See? So the first command is here philosophically deteriorated in learning, obey yourself. Do what you please. Be free. You can hardly understand the importance of my sentence, obey God more than men, as long as you say, I never obey a man anyway. So why should I obey God more than men, you see? But of course, my command, gentlemen, is a truly religious command because it includes my own commands. I shall not obey myself. I shall not obey myself is included in the sentence, I shall not obey men more than God, you see. I may God obey myself as long as God is in agreement with me, you see. But sometimes you have to turn against your own vices, and you must not obey yourself. Everybody knows this, gentlemen, but most people today deny it officially. So we get immediately the corruption of the best into the worst. Here is the right commandment, obey God more than men. If you corrupt this, it means obey nobody. But if you analyze this sentence, which is a good American sentence, be independent, you see. Plagiarize everybody, but obey nobody. Flaunt your parents, etc. Well, usually it would have to be translated, obey yourself. Because everybody has to obey somebody. Now here you see a typical example of corrupt religion. Here are three sentences, you see. They look all quite different. This, to use an understandable, you see, I don't know, of course. I had a sophomore here in class who wrote on top of his paper, I've never heard of prayer, and I don't know what it is for. Well, that's just a representative of your generation. Anybody who can say this, gentlemen, has, of course, no access to religion, as we should see, because he cannot distinguish between God and himself. Prayer means to become aware of the existence of more than yourself and other men. It's very simple. Here you have three sentences, gentlemen. This is that which means religion and all from the first man to the last, as long as there is religion. If you have your own philosophy, you will come to the conclusion that liberty is better than tyranny, you see, and slavery, so you have to say obey nobody. And in fact, that means, if we, from our point of view, reveal what it means obey yourself. Isn't that true? So we have three sentences. This is a corruption, gentlemen. This is the virtuous veneer of corruption. That is the typical worldly, secular cloak of irreligion. And this is the religious sentence. And in every case you will find, gentlemen, that the man who denies religion will never express what he is in for in the appropriate term, but always with this cloak. Every philosopher or every independence maniac or every, rebel or whatnot will say, oh, I'm just wonderful because I obey nobody. They will never admit that this means obey yourself. The corruption, gentlemen, of religion will only be, of course, be voiced and worded by the man who has religion. The anti-religious person will, of course, express the corruption in so many other words. I knew a little young girl who said she had to go to bed with many men because they were so otherwise so unhappy, and she had to serve them, and that was her great act of love. Well, it's a very nice circumscription for saying that she was a harlot, you see. But she cannot call herself a harlot. No woman can say, I am a harlot. I had a young Dartmouth friend, he's now a professor, I hope he has improved in his spirituality. He went to Paris, and of course, why do Americans go to Paris, and why do they support this ridiculous country politically all the time? Because they dine there well and drink there well, and they go to bed with women. They can't afford this in this country so cheaply. So Americans are corrupted by France, and that's why everybody has to pay lip service to the beauty and the greatness of France in this country. It's ridiculous. But the tradition is only that the corruption which you shun in this country, to have many mistresses, you see, you can afford in France. And mistresses are highly seductive. Very nice to have, occasionally. Usually, the year later, it's not so nice. But in the first moment, it seems so very convincing. Now, gentlemen, this girl, boy from Dartmouth here, hungry for life, went to Montmartre. And he settled with a little girl. And when he came back, this idiot, he always called her my little prostitute. Which shows that an American just shouldn't go to France. And that he is certainly not a human being very easily. Because a man who calls the person to whom, with whom he goes to bed a prostitute and not Litzy or whatever her name was, or Lucy, is not a human being. You are infamous, that's infamous. He had no right to call this girl who made him happy for a moment, you see, call her any longer prostitute. I have many words for a name, for a person. For the police, she might have been a prostitute. For the doctor, she might have been a prostitute. For this man, she had to be his little girl. And there you see your schizophrenic character with regard to Europe and here. When an American travels, he's out of bounds. And he behaves, he even rapes girls in Holland in the occupation. An American soldier did this who was a college graduate. A 14-year-old girl. Why can't he would have never thought of this at home? Holland was an allied country. Was not. And yet, he thinks there is another world in which he just can do as he pleases. That's a typical weakness of most Americans. They have only an American religion which holds good in America. And there's no religion at all abroad. And my friend, since when here on this shore, when he told me about his experience, called this girl a little prostitute. You see, I could have slapped him in the face. He was too old for this. But he deserved spanking. You see, because he showed that he had not the power to throw himself behind his act and to see that this was a human being whom he had liked for a moment, perhaps even loved. And in calling her a little prostitute, he showed the impotency of the human oxen, which most Americans are in with regard to sex affairs. An oxen is a man who cannot spiritually accompany his physical actions. He only can go to bed with a girl, but he cannot speak about it in dignified terms. Now, gentlemen, a potent man is a man who can look down to who he really is and admit who he is. And you are all star-eyed idealists and philosophers who think how men should be, and what you really do has nothing to do with it. Look down to your acts and speak in unison with your acts. And don't look up to your ideas, which are no good anyway. Religion is against philosophy because it is not idealistic, gentlemen. This boy tried to be an idealist coming home and still looking down onto this little girl. But he should have looked up to his actions there and should have said, well, obviously, since I went to bed with her, she can't have been a prostitute only. She must have also been a human being. And he would have learned something. But you with your philosophy, gentlemen, you say, I obey only myself. Or you say, I obey nobody. So he didn't even obey the presence of this little woman who should have told him that under heaven there are many more human relations than his vocabulary of a Dartmouth student had ever taught him. And he had to find a new expression, mistress or whatnot, for this word. Because religion, gentlemen, is the admission that not I call things arbitrarily or people, but I learn by my relations who they are. To give you a simpler example, here another Dartmouth boy, a teacher in a high school now here in New Hampshire, went to England as a soldier, and he got engaged to a very, as far as I can make out, very fine English girl. And when he departed for the United States, she came to the station, and she broke down and wept, and was quite beside herself, because after all, she knew what life was, and that a soldier going home may not be faithful, and she was in love with this boy. And therefore, he cancels the engagement, because a girl who is so passionate that she breaks down in a public place and cries was not for him. Now, that's still worse than calling the girl for of a moment a prostitute, you see. He didn't deserve to experience life. He was an absolute atheist. Can you understand this? Why it is more important to take such a fact to study religion, gentlemen, than all the people who go to church? This boy, if he's still unmarried, I am glad to say, and I hope this curse will follow him and he will never get married. He doesn't deserve it. Can you see my disgust? Can you understand it? Here is a man who is given by God the greatest gift there is on life, the real passion of a woman. And she expresses in the only human way, which is only has been abolished in the United States of America, by weeping. And he says, weeping is not for me. So he could not accept the command that if a good woman weeps, he has to learn that weeping is a part of life. That would have been obeying God more than men. Because what he had learned in high school or in Dartmouth College, that people don't cry, is just human, is it not? That's not a divine experience, gentlemen. That's just silly. And you all are silly because you don't weep. And so you can only grin and you can never laugh. Nobody can laugh, gentlemen, who cannot cry. You want to laugh all the time, and so I despise your laughter. Your laughter in the nugget gives me the creeps. It's so coarse. Because I know you only can laugh there, you can never cry. I had this experience once. We had a tremendous Russian movie here, Peter the Great. And there was an actress who played the Tsarina, the wife of Peter. He had gotten her out of the gutter and had made her his empress. And he was going to die. And she thought it was all finished. And in her great love, she threw herself over this dying Tsar on his bed and began to break down. And this whole theater in Hanover resounded with laughter. And when I asked the boys the next day in class, why did you laugh? They said, because, you know the reason? Because we were quite sure that this could never have happened to us. We would never break down and cry. Such a man has no religion, because he only obeys himself and his routine. He cannot experience the necessity of mending his ways and learning that crying is the most sublime utterance of the human heart. These are three examples, gentlemen. The prostitute, the tears of the fiancé, gentlemen, and your behavior in the movies, by which you can learn more about this whole course, gentlemen, and religion, than in any book of philosophy and theology. Now perhaps you begin to understand why religion has nothing to do, or very little, with philosophy and theology, you see. It is the power to obey God more than men and to treat living processes more than dead. You want to have the stony face of a lady at the railroad station who is all smiles and gives you some chocolate. And here this boy found a girl who was breaking down and in despair, and he couldn't take it. And the same with the Tsarina, and the same with the ideology and the philosophy of this young man who went to Paris and saw there a real little girl whom he liked and with whom he wanted to bed and who he labeled afterwards my little prostitute. There is no my little prostitute. Can you see this? It's impossible. Doesn't exist. My never goes with prostitute. Prostitute is for statistics. For an objective for you, but not my little prostitute. But this power to appropriate a new experience, gentlemen, is religion. Would you care to take this down? the power to appropriate a new experience and to bow to it and to give it a new name. Therefore, gentlemen, all religion goes with new names. Where there is religion, there is a new name for God. And this boy had to come home from England and had to say, that is the greatest experience of my life. For the first time in my life, I have seen a young woman cry for me. And I have to make up for this for the rest of my life, lest I not deserve it. Gentlemen, there is no greater gift for any human being than to have somebody who cries for him. And if this is not a religious experience, there is just no religious experience. But you don't think religious experience has something to do with the Vatican, or with the Christian Science, or with the Mormons. It's much simpler, gentlemen. It is your power to appropriate a new experience as being superior to all men, human-made, manufactured, you see, manipulated ideas and conventions. Most of you can never do this. You are all second rate as long as you have not this immediate power, this potency, gentlemen, to call a new experience with a new name. Now we have already reached a great insight from this point of view, gentlemen. God is the power which makes us give to a new experience a new name. You can only do this, you see, under divine inspiration. He had to break down because he no longer, you see, obeyed his self, his former self. He became a new person by making this one new contact, this one new experience. On the other hand, gentlemen, there's another corruption from the other end. We now come to the opposite end of religion. This was the second sentence. Very simple sentence. You have to obey God more than men, including yourself. But we have also to make things obey us. You have to handle the car, you have to sit down, you have to heat this house, you have to treat the bread and butter of every day decently. You shall not waste, you shall cook, and all the things of life have to be treated. You see, there has to be wood, despite the New York Times Sunday edition, even 50 years for men, so we have to have conservation. And all these mean things, the things given us, you see, have to be treated in some way. And the dead things can be treated more freely by us manipulated than the living beings. Now, gentlemen, I take a bet. If you meet 100 other boys on campus and you try to explain this command to them, the second command of which I'm now going to speak, make things, dead things, obey you more than living beings, or command preferably things than human beings, which means, again, the freedom of the other fellow, you see. Command preferably things instead of living beings. You would always translate it in this way to the other fellow. Or command dead things preferably to living things. That is, you would give the etiquette thing even to the living. And as I see it in this campus, if you have to speak of God, you always say, well, you know that thing or something. The word thing in you, gentlemen, has become all but mine. As you say of yourself, obey yourself to the exclusion of other authorities, especially God, but also your parents or anybody else. So you also say of the world at large that you are surrounded by things. And you call me also something. If I do formulate the sentence, command dead things preferable to living things, you already have corrupted religion. Because you have given the higher, the living being, the term thing from the Lord, from the devil. The word thing is the second great sin of the American college boy. That he calls living processes and living beings also things. Things do only apply to dead. As soon as you give the word thing to anybody who deserves to be
called you, and he and she, he has confused life and death. And you all confuse life and death by your abuse of the word thing. And I would then say, gentlemen, the right word is command things as against men. And the corruption is, you would say command nobody, which you cannot do. Or you would say there is nothing to command, and you would introduce the word in nothing as you have it. And most American boys think there's nothing good about commanding. And you actually would like to live in a world what you call democracy. You see, where nobody gives orders, nobody takes orders. And the rest of you is corrupt. But it isn't. You have to find the beautiful order in which everybody takes orders and which everybody gives orders, but in the appropriate order of things and living beings and bodies. You can't give orders to God. Give as few orders as possible to human beings. And give all the orders there are to things. You would agree with me that it is perfectly all right to manufacture and manipulate wood and iron and steel and gold and silver, you see. No objection to this, isn't it true? Already, with artificial insemination of bulls, of cows, it's a doubtful procedure. You will see immediately, can you really command the cow to be inseminated now as they all do? I think we'd have to fight that out in the future. I'm not so sure. I think it comes to ladies who don't have liquid and husbands and go to students and get themselves artificially inseminated, I would just say that's impossible. And it's done in this country, but the question. Because these women cannot be made to obey like things. And the men who give their seven cannot be made to be treated like machines. They put in $5 on top, and then they, I don't know how they do it, but it must be a fair, distasteful action of onanism or what it is to get this semen out of these males. And I'm told that students sell their own sperm. Is that true? Well, this man is abused, is he not? He's abused. And that's a scandal that goes on in this country. And we call this a religious country under God. That's the devil. Because men here are, for money, treated as machines, as things. So you see, religion tells you that although you can make money, you can't do it. It is not right to make money, you see, in any way you please. If your body then has to be manipulated, you become a pig. And that's a real question as of today, because this may come to you as a temptation any minute. And these are the real questions, gentlemen. What do I care, as I said once more, for all your misunderstanding of religion? A religion is there where you cannot treat your own self, you see, as a thing. Can you see the point, Margulia? It is very simple, gentlemen. It's very, you know all your own sex troubles, gentlemen. As long as you are not married, you are in great danger of splitting up into the thing, sex, and into your own mind. And you know how unhappy it makes you. You go crazy over it. People go to the mental asylum because they split into two things. They treat themselves as things, you see, which nobody can do. And you split into two. So, gentlemen, why do we have these two commands? Look them over. We saw here the I would say the secular form of this command, command as men, I would see the American idol mechanized, have machinery, replaced by machinery, mechanized, with an exclamation mark as an imperative. But that is not the right hierarchy. If you mechanize, you can mechanize your own body too, you see. Then you are very unhappy. If you look this over, gentlemen, you see that the universe is tackled in these two commandments. There are three elements, or four. There are God, there are men, in the plural, all men, you see, including yourself, and there is a world of things. So would you cut it down, gentlemen? The religion has the problem of organizing or of placing the divine, the gods, men, and things. And we may take it very simply today and say God, men, world. All religion, gentlemen, tries to rhyme God, men, and world. However, no religious man says this at the beginning. That's philosophy, copying religion, so to speak. And the human mind can speak of God, world, and men. Your human experience, gentlemen, the boy who goes to England and sees a girl crying for him, really experiences there only one God, the God of love. He doesn't experience right away the whole of God, you see. Therefore, I warn you, gentlemen, if we have a course on religion, we must speak of more than one God. To believe in one God is only one, perhaps the highest religion, you see. But it's not the beginning of your experience. At this moment, you experience sports as one God, sex as another God, science as a third God, politics as a fourth God, you see, family pride as a fifth God, but you do not experience God. You have no way of really experiencing God without having experienced gods. Who knows Hebrew? Anybody know? Does anybody happen to know Hebrew? You may recall that in the Bible, the one word for God is a plural, the Elohim. And that means all the gods together in one. And that's the true experience of any decent fellow, that all of you have religion, gentlemen, because all of you have one God at least, usually several. But you would never say that sex is all of God, you see. But it's your ruling passion. The same is true, actually even worse, with philosophers. The philosophers always think that if they make out something about M-A-N, they have understood something about M-E-N. Now, you know very well that the whole problem of life is not between M-A-N, if there was only one man. But the problem is that here are 43 people in this room. And we must understand each other and act together, you see, and fight each other, etc. So, gentlemen, all philosophers are terribly clever in dodging the second plural, which is the real thing. How do two or more people believe the same thing? And how do they believe even in the same God? That's very miraculous. And so I don't wish to cheat you, gentlemen. I say the formula God, man, and world is a philosophical formula. The experimental formula of your life, gentlemen, is gods, men, M-E-N, and things. If these things form a real one world, it is very doubtful. The Hindus believe that there are many worlds. It makes less of my sense. Is the mind the world by itself? Is it really our world? Like all these stratospheric stories, not right to tell us, they are all nonsensical and worthless because they are just duplications of us, these masks you see inhabitants. But there are many worlds, perhaps, and certainly you don't even know of the unity of the world. What you actually experience in life, there are terribly many things of which you would like to buy or to eat or to consume or to get out of the way or to dominate, you see, or to sell or to buy or whatever it is. That's all we know. So, gentlemen, the fight between philosophy and religion comes out. Religion can have the honesty of saying, I know only parts of God, I know gods. I know only parts of men's character, I know men. I never shall know all men. But I have some dealings with some men, you see. And they seem all to be very difficult people to get along with. And here comes this proud word of world. If you are really interested in religion, gentlemen, then you must speak of things. Now, you will find, gentlemen, that the one corruption of religion by which it is ruined is this cheap talk of God, men, and world. To people who have not first made to make the connection of several people, of many things, you see, and of several gods. Before you have experienced gods, you cannot experience God. That's why we have at least the Trinity in Christianity, to remind you of the fact that if you have not met one other man as divine, Jesus of Nazareth, you cannot know who his father is. It's hopeless. It's nonsense. The Jews said the same. They said, either you are an Israelite or a Gentile. In both cases, you can see the power of one God who has set the nations of the world as against the Jews, and the Jews as against the nations. So again, you have two ways of God, at least, before you can know who God is. God has led these nations different ways, and contrary ways, you see. But they both have to be there to enable the world to come to its appointed end when the Messiah comes. Even the Jews, although they stress the unity of God so much, you see, at least admit that the people on this earth experience God in a very different manner. So, gentlemen, be wise. And that's the greatest progress we can make at this moment in this class. That I invite you to see that the commands which you really have to realize in your life are not so simple dealing with God, men, and world. They're much more complicated if you have 5 million things and if you have 2 billion men, you see, and if you have an innumerable galaxy of angels and archangels and dominions and powers and principalities, as the Bible calls them, you see, and foreign gods and devils, and you have to decide who is your God. Very cheap if you say there's just one God, you see. But then I have no guarantee that you know what you mean by this term at all. Let's have a break here. About this distinction between God and gods, men and men, world and things. Now, I wish to tell you that I have found within myself and in others that always when the mind dominates, that is when I'm irreligious, then I'm tempted to brush aside these three entities as God, men and world. All your psychology deals with men in the singular. That's very simple. Solves nothing. Because we never are men in the singular. You're always your mother's son, you see, and your son's father. And that's, you see, very complicated business. And you never are just the men. But the fiction of philosophy and everything connected with it is to try to persuade you that if you know something about men, then your troubles are solved. Then they begin. Because then you are already, you see, ready to go to a lunatic asylum once you think that M-A-N can be treated by himself. He cannot. Religion tells you that you are under the power of gods or
demons, if you may, or spirits, and that you are always tempted to command your brothers or to take orders from your brothers, and that you have to command things. So, the second question concerns this confusion. If you put this in this order, the dividing line between this and this runs right through it. If I call you individuals, I treat you as things, as dead things. By themselves, they can be counted, they can be set aside, but I treat you as an individual, and therefore I can come to manipulate you in a mob or in a mass. The police would do this, you see. If 1,000 individuals of questionable dignity line up before a prison, the warden will think that they may try to free the prisoner, and he may take a hose and spray them with water. And he treats them as things, does he not? Any mob is treated that way. In a war, we treat the enemy as nature. Now, nature is just another expression for a plurality of things which can be manipulated. And therefore, gentlemen, whoever goes to war, whoever is in the police, whoever is in the FBI, whoever is in a tax collector, whoever does something for the state, for the government, you see, to other people, is tempted to treat them as things, as cases, as we say. Because the moment a man becomes a thing, he's a case. And gentlemen, in this country, the most people escape religion by treating themselves as cases. So what's the greatest case mania today for all of you? How do you treat yourself as cases when you go to whom? Me? Of course, you see. He treats you as a case. And a case is a man casus. You know what's the English translation of casus? You don't know what cadre means? Me? No? What to? Well, somebody must know what casus means. Fall, it means. A fall. Gentlemen, fallen man is a case. We have now, as you know, formally abolished religion, and there is no fallen man, and there is no original sin. And the secular mind, always very wonderful in his splitting the truth from his veneer, from his concealment, calls himself a case. Well, in former days we called ourselves sinners, which meant we had fallen from grace. Now the modern analytical idiot gives all his money to the psychoanalyst, $8,000 a year. I have a friend who pays now $6,400 a year for annually, that is $13,000 to a psychoanalyst who listens 3 hours a day, a week, to this man's toilet stories. And he has made himself into a case. Was a fine boy, he flunked Dartmouth because of drinking. He worked himself up again, graduated from Harvard, and then his nervous system gave out, and he's now, and I admired him, for he had stamina for 10 years. Now he's 25, and it is all gone. And he, for the next 2 years, his father has to pay the psychoanalyst $6,500 a year, as I told you, for 3 sittings a week. And the boy has decided not to make any decision in the meantime, and just to be a passer. You see a little rack in the hand of this criminal. And so, gentlemen, here you have a wonderful case of secular religion. This boy has a religion that the psychoanalyst is a priest and that he is a case. And that he has no responsibility since he pays $6,500 good money. The psychoanalyst is in charge. And this boy, of course, wouldn't think of becoming a Roman Catholic because he would say, there the clergyman is in charge of my soul and I want to be a captain of my soul, and so I have to be a Protestant. But he goes to the pseudo-clergyman, to the pseudo-priest, and he pays him high money, which the Catholic priest wouldn't even ask for, you see, and he's a case. Gentlemen, a case is a man treated as a thing in his own eyes. And that's what the old religions meant by the fact of original sin. That man who has fallen from grace is a man who prefers to be treated as a thing. Because it's convenient. Because he has no longer himself any relation to the gods. That somebody has his charge. The psychoanalyst has to know all the answers, you see. And the case hasn't. The case has no... He has just... etched away, I think is the best word, or cauterized away his own connection with the divine. Such a case, men would always speak of my little prostitute. Such a case, men would not marry a girl who weeps for him. Such a case, men waits for somebody else, others, or has to know what he has to do. So this man lives by indirection. As you know, most people in this country want to live to be one of them. They have promiscuity. They sleep three boys and three girls in the same room together and think nothing of it. It's more innocent than if they are alone. And they don't wish to be bothered in their conscience with any decisions they have to make. This is a country of religious slaves in this country. You are all right for the Roman Catholic Church or for Tibetan prayer meals because you actually go to the psychoanalyst and you are not ashamed of yourself. I have a friend with whom I have been friendly since my sixth year. So he has watched all my vicissitudes in Europe and here. And he's in this country now too, out in Oregon. And last year he visited and he said, Eugen, that's my first name, he said, I've always respected you for one thing. You have never carried all your troubles to the psychiatrist. And you have been in great trouble. And you have always poured it out, really. And not, you see, second rate. This, gentlemen, your psychiatric treatment is always second rate. It's like hypnosis as against obedience. If I obey, you see, an officer who gives me an order, I'm still a free man. If I'm hypnotized, I'm not. You see, it's the same act, it's the same practice, it makes you obey. And so people think, why not hypnotism? Because I am out, you see, I'm treated as a thing. Hypnotism isn't bad in its results, but it's bad, you see, in the hypnotizer's relation to me, because he has no right to treat me as a thing. He kills me. He takes away some living spirit from me, as he brought this home. Now, in an emergency system, as with the mob who gangs up before the prison, the warden has every right to treat these men as things. And I don't say that a hypnotizer against the beast is not right, you see. If the person is in great danger, you have to treat this person perhaps in his own interest as a thing. You can see a drunkard, you see. Three people have to grab him and put him in a taxi and bring him to bed. Is that right? But he also knows when he wakes up next morning that he has been treated as a thing. So will you kindly note, gentlemen, that all of us, when we are asleep, and when we are drunk, when we are hypnotized, and when we are afraid, have to be treated as things. So the great difficulty of the religious task is, gentlemen, to state in so many words that man is half a thing, that it has to take orders. And half he is divine because he can give orders. And therefore this is your difficulty to discover when is man a thing and when is man a god and when he's just your brother. Because obviously we are all three, you see, in alternation. Now we come therefore to this most difficult statement I have to make today, gentlemen. Whom we have to call God, what we have to call a thing, we never know ahead of time. Whom we have to call God and what we have to call a thing, we never know ahead of time. I have nothing to do with you. I know no Spanish. I can't help you. This is another class.
Okay, thank you.
He had to be treated as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then that is why religion is perpetual and is a power really in you and my life. It is not connected with any origin just in the past. This discovery, which element in you and me is just beastly or thing-like, you see, or case-like, and which thing in me is, which power in me is has the authority to give orders, is undecided. Tomorrow, the same man who was a wise ruler yesterday maybe have become a tyrant. The same child which had to take orders when it was 4 may have to be emancipated when it's 14. There you see a very simple problem. And you know, in this country, this is not known. In this country, gentlemen, and that was what made the Englishman say there is no religion in America. In this country, you have all fallen into the strange philosophical idolatry or frozenness or rigidity. You say God is always God, man is always man, and things are always things. And you have not come to understand that to use your own potency, you see, to create the decision of who is God and what is thing inside yourself and others is the process of living. That is human life, gentlemen, not eating, not sleeping, but decide every day who is God and what is thing. I'll read you now for showing the difference between the English and the Americans, an article today in the New York Times. And you will kindly take down the, jot down the spots, the points made here, and tell me afterwards, after some thinking, why the English have a different religion from us. London. Juvenile delinquency in Great Britain last year dropped by 14%. There were 45,000 arrests in 52, but in 1953, 38,000. 4 probation homes and 2 juvenile courts have been closed for lack of offenders. Here is how Britain went about it. Home Secretary David Maxwell Five, Britain's top law enforcement officer, has this maxim: children are not naturally good citizens. Take this against the American maxim, man is good by nature. The greatest heresy of Benjamin Franklin. Man is good by nature. That's, you know, the 18th century heresy of the Enlightenment, which even most Christian ministers here try to propagate, because otherwise they wouldn't be allowed to preach. Children are not naturally good citizens versus the American, man is good by nature. It's ridiculous, the sentence. It's hard to believe that anybody ever believes it, but America has been founded on this heresy that man is good by nature. And this comes from the watertight compartment that all men are by themselves always men. I try to show you that at times we are PC, and at times we are God, and at times we are men. That is, we never know whom we have against us. You meet a man, he may be Jesus Christ, reborn, you see, on this earth. And he may be just a criminal, you see. And he may be just a wild beast, a madman. Do you know? We don't. You see, the Americans have this straight jacket system of thinking about God, man, and world that you even are a pacifist. A pacifist is a man who says that men can never become a beast, or an institution can never be dead, you see. A pacifist says that it's never worthwhile to lay down your life for your brethren, or for God's honor. Pacifism knows ahead of time who is man, who is God, and who are things. And that comes all from the American system of thinking that this is all in nature predecided. Well, let's go on here with the English system. There are 7 points made in England. In the Cliff Seaport of Liverpool, more than 600 youth clubs have been started in the last 5 years. Second, in Wigan, Lancashire, parents of young offenders must appear in court with their children. In many cases, they are fined heavily. By the way, will you kindly watch the word cases, in many cases, you see? Where the children are not humans, the parents have to act as the human representatives, you see, and they are fined. Very good case, you see, where a thing has to be represented in court by a living human, and the child is treated as a case. On the Isle of Man, juvenile delinquents are flogged. Whipping was abolished in 48, then brought back in 52. The child crime rate has plummeted. Now, point three obviously has to do with American religion. It's against American religion to treat your brother man as your brother, because therefore you can't spank him. He's a god in his own right, or a devil. And so you make children into miserables because they aren't spanked. And you, of course, for you, with you it's too late. You should have spanked in your youth, but your parents were forbidden to do so because of American religion. Because of this impotency to declare that this boy at that moment was just a brat and had to be brought up short against his being a nuisance by being spanked. I once saved the life of a man by spanking him, by slapping him in the face. He was my subaltern officer. I was in command of a town at the battlefront in France on the German side. And he was my lieutenant, second lieutenant. He was 18 years of age. And I had to make him the officer on guard of the day, and so he had to take one of the watches. Was there in the Battle of the Somme, it was a very dangerous situation. We didn't know where the enemy was. The trench warfare was interrupted by this attack of the British on the line of the Somme. We had tremendous casualties. There were many hundred thousand people killed in this battle on both sides. It was November, it was mud time, mud season, rainy, so very wild and stormy nights, very early darkness. It was very uncomfortable. The boy was denounced to me in the morning by the staff sergeant as having slept on his watch. And that is, you know, in wartime at the front is enough to have him shot. He tremblingly reported to me in full, full uniform with a helmet and his white bandolier they wore at that time and everything as you report for court-martial, you see. And here was his 18-year-old promising boy, and here was his end of life, or his at least being disgraced, you see, totally for the rest of his life. And so with all the might I had in my command, I slapped him in the face and let it be done, and didn't court-martial him. And my slapping him was the only way of a paternal action, you see, by which I took the authority of the inner circle of the family instead of the external circle of the legal authority, which I also represented. He being on my staff, I felt at liberty to switch loyalty, so to speak, you see. As my officer, he was still my younger brother, but as I was a man of command, I had also a responsibility to my other men. Why did I have to slap him? Because I had to break him down. I had to show all my other men that he couldn't get away with murder and that he had dishonored. But by treating him as a boy who could be spanked, you see, I convinced all these old other men that they also should not insist on his punishment. See, he moved in an inner circle where you just spank a man and don't have a formal trial. You may have heard that the opposite occurs in the United States. These idiots of progressive educators, they have invented school courts where poor little children are really treated as though they were delinquents, and they have an attorney, and there is a case made of this, you see, and they plead guilty, and then the student council, you have it in Dartmouth Hour, so this ridiculous treatment, they try to pass judgment. That is, you build up a child into an adult. Now, in my case, I did the opposite. I took down this seeming adult, you see, into the state of a child. And thereby I saved him. 10 years later, he brought his young wife to me and thanked me for my action, because I had saved his life. But gentlemen, it cannot be done more cheaply. It cannot be done without spanking. It cannot be done by ranting or by treating him as a man to whom I can give a sermon. Then I would have treated him as a grown-up. I had to exemplify that he was a thing in my eyes. You cannot understand this. You would never have slapped him in the face. You would have court-martialed him, as you do with these poor school children, the seniors in high school, for whom you have legal courts. And that's the whole idiocy of our modern society. To try to not to know when to treat a man as a harmless thing, which can be gotten out of the way, and when to treat him as a man. Once a human being born in the cradle, you already treat him as a responsible, independent person. The boy at 2 has already to decide what he wants to eat. You see, make his own decisions. You deprive him of the real opportunities when he should be treated as an annex to the grown-ups, as a thing. It's not a dishonor to be treated as a thing. But a thing demands to be treated. And when you have to treat your child as a thing, as the English do, then you spank it. Number 4, in the schools, teachers have complete latitude to dole out corporal punishment. Whipping is commonplace. Discipline is excellent. 5, movies are graded and children are barred from these made for adults. Television is supervised rigidly, and the children's program rarely carry anything more gory than a Western movie. Horror comic books can be obtained only at American military posts in England. Take that down. That's why you know why we are so little loved in Europe. We are not hated for our mores, but for our lack of mores. Horror comic books can be obtained only at American military posts. Again, your impotency to distinguish between when a man should be treated as a case and when he should be treated as a free agent. A man who wants to read horror comic books is not a human being. He has not been, anyone deserves no respect. And you cannot understand that. British parents are very strict with their children. And 7, children are subject to the same criminal law as adults. They are tried in special juvenile courts. But if the magistrate decides they are hopeless cases, they can be sent to jail for long terms. Well, these 7 points, what would you think is a religious point in the strongestly showing a religious implication? They are all, of course, declaring the religious conviction of the English people as against the Americans. And you can see that a country has a religion. There is an American religion. The American religion is a philosophical religion of nature. And it worships nature. All do. And therefore, the nature of a man is already there from the beginning, you see. He is never alternatingly a god or a thing or a man, you see. He has a nature. And the nature has to be treated by persuasion, you see, and wages, and bribes. He cannot be spanked. He cannot be treated. You cannot withhold anything from him, like this horror comic book, you see. And so men's nature is the religion of America. God has a nature, man has a nature, things have a nature. That's irreligious, gentlemen. All religion is the power to abolish the notion of nature. You cannot have religion, gentlemen, without admitting that nothing is natural. That at this moment, the miracle is to know what is man, what is God, and what is thing. And all these 3 aspects of reality, you see, change all the time. You cannot rely that a man is by nature a man. He can be a maniac. He can be a beast, you see. He can be childish, as I try to do in this case, you see. I have to take him down and not treat him as an adult man. So we'll see next time, then, gentlemen. The religion of nature in America, I think, is the first religion we should try to come to know, because you know it so well. You all believe in it. You have a religion without knowing it, and we, of course, have to deal with this problem under the two aspects. What is the content of the religion of nature in America? And how far can you yourself deny it, or how far are we all compelled into it?